January 18th, 2025. And we are here in our own little quiet corner of the world, the Bhayagiri Monastery. And just not quite 2 weeks into our winter retreat period. It's a very special time for us. So I feel at this point things are settling down quite a bit. And we're well into our 3 weeks of group practice that we're starting the retreat out with. And after that, it'll open up a little bit more. The schedule will be more open, and we'll start with individuals. We'll be having solitary retreats. There'll be a rotation of solitary retreats, the monastic community getting two-week retreats, and then also the lay retreat crew getting 1 week solitary retreats. So we'll be on like a about just before the end of January, there will be a few people on solitary retreat at any given time. And then the rest of us will continue with the retreat schedule here, a bit more open schedule. But right now it's a full schedule, full practice schedule. So we're doing quite a bit of meditation, morning and evening pujas, chanting and meditation, and then morning meditation session and afternoon meditation session, sitting and walking meditation. And the practice is very basic. It's very simple. There's not much to do apart from just watch our minds and just deal with the hindrances and mental and perhaps physical obstacles as they arise. But just sitting, just walking, these are very basic activities. It's really all we have to do, and we're all engaging in these practices. And then the retreat crew is looking after the kitchen and the maintenance and so on, so that we have the space and the time to undertake these basic practices and be able to focus on them completely. So, and the Buddha taught the practices of sitting and walking meditation for training the heart to learn how to let go of attachments, and how to be peaceful. If we don't let go of attachments, we can never be peaceful. That's how things work. That's how it works. And if we are able to let go of attachments, then the heart can settle down and be peaceful. And however much we are not able to let go of attachments, to that extent, the heart will not be peaceful. And however much we are able to let go of attachments, then to that extent, the heart will be peaceful. To the point that the carrot on the stick that the Buddha is dangling in front of us is that if we let go of all attachments, then we can be completely peaceful. And this comes through these practices that we hear about all the time. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. Sila being the root of the practice. That's the undertaking of precepts, virtue, virtuous behavior, good conduct. And Samadhi, the practice of meditation and the attempt to use a meditation object in order to cause the proliferating mind to settle down a bit. And then the panya, the discernment or wisdom that we develop, that's the wisdom that sees the arising and passing away of all the sankharas, the conditioned phenomena, mental and physical, and that through samadhi, through meditation, we can suppress the defilements. We can suppress things like greed and anger and attachment temporarily. But it's only through panya, it's only through wisdom that we can really let go, we can really be peaceful. So we can think of this as panya, discernment, is a type of wisdom which is natural and automatic, and it's following the laws of nature. So it's the Dhamma, when the Dhamma is seen, it's just the natural order of things, just the natural way of things. So it's, I like to use the analogy of the hand in the fire. So it's like when we put our hand in a fire, the hand just withdraws automatically from the fire. And so that's the wisdom of the hand. That's the wisdom of the body. It just withdraws automatically. When we put our hand in a fire, we don't have to consult an instruction manual about how to get your hand out of a fire. It's just automatic. It automatically withdraws from the fire. So when wisdom, when the heart sees the arising and passing away of everything, when the heart has discernment, then it doesn't need to consult the Buddha's teachings, the suttas, and so on. The mind will withdraw automatically from suffering. It won't be able to stay in the fire of suffering. It will have to withdraw automatically. It won't be able to stay in anymore because it'll see the ludicrousy of it. It'll see that it's crazy to stay suffering. And we might have these small experiences sometimes where we actually think, how could I have done that before? That was so much suffering. I was causing myself so much suffering. But then when we see it clearly, then everything is cool and peaceful and there's not a problem. And we might even think, how could I have been creating so many problems for myself before? How could I be creating so many worries for myself before? But that's just how it is. There are things we haven't seen that we need to see. There's things we haven't realized yet that we have to realize. There are things we need to let go of that we haven't yet let go of. But then once we see, once we realize, once we do let go, then we'll be able to look back and say, okay, I didn't see before, now I see. I didn't realize before, now I realize. I didn't let go before, now I can let go, at least to a certain extent. So that's good to acknowledge. It's kind of like an adventure, being on a practice session, a long practice session like the winter retreat, 3 months of practice, precious opportunity to actually say, okay, well, there's ways in which the mind still isn't clear. What might it be like if I was to make things more clear? And there's ways now in which the mind is still attached. How can I work and find skillful means to lessen that attachment? There's ways right now that the mind hasn't realized what the Buddha said we need to realize, and how can I work toward realizing those things? And this takes effort. It takes a certain type of effort. It's not necessarily a physical effort, although there is a physical component in terms of just getting ourselves to sit meditation, getting ourselves to walk meditation, getting ourselves to push the envelope a little bit, getting ourselves to sleep a little bit less, not a lot less, but just a little bit less, just pushing within our capacity. Then we can make progress. The attachment can become a little bit less. The discernment can become a little bit more. Longpo Cha would use the analogy of he would talk about samadhi and panya, so the analogy of the candle and the flame, that if we meditate, it's like we have a candle. It's if we have samadhi, but we don't have panya, then it's like we have a candle, but we don't have a flame. So the candle doesn't do much for us. It doesn't light up the darkness. But if we have some discernment, some wisdom, we've maybe had some insight into the nature of conditioned phenomena, the nature of impermanence, suffering, not self. We might have had a little bit of insight, but the samadhi isn't strong, the mind isn't firm and stable and settled. That's like lighting a match in the darkness, and it does truly illuminate things temporarily, but then it goes out really quickly. So what we need is a candle and a match, and we need to touch the match to the candle, and then we can light up the darkness for a long time and see clearly for a long time. So that's, we need both of these things. We need to develop the samadhi and we need to develop the panya as well. And so that's what we're trying to do with the winter retreat schedule. We have several hours a day that we're able to engage in the meditation, the sitting and the walking meditation, and then also listening to readings, listening to teachings, getting that discerning capacity going. Yeah. There's also another way we could think about this. It's when Longpa Plien was visiting Abhayagiri for 2 weeks in 2007. And I remember a teaching that he gave that stuck with me, where he said, actually, I think it was during a Q&A session with him, and people asking about developing samadhi. And he said, samadhi is good, but it's just like cleaning a room. So once you clean a room and you have a nice, clean, empty room, then you have to use it somehow to some benefit. So just having samadhi without panya is like having an empty, clean room. But then having panya is you start to put useful things in that clean room. And so you start to put whatever you need in it, some chairs, some furniture, and then you can actually stay in it, a desk or whatever you might need. So, or another way we could think about this is that the story of when a long time ago, when the monk named Ajahn Bunkhao was a junior monk living with Longpo Cha at Wat Nong Papong, and he was Longpo Cha's ubatak. And this young monk, he had a lot of samadhi. He had a very natural samadhi, so he could go very, very deep, very quickly, very easily. It's a problem that a lot of us don't really have, but he had this issue. He could go very deep, very easily, and he could actually be in a state of great ease and well-being. But it was really dependent on not having any sensory contact, sensory impingement coming from outside. So he was Longpo Cha's attendant for a time, and then Longpo Cha would receive people for many hours a day. People would come and ask him questions about their lives, and Longpo Cha would be constantly receiving a steady stream of guests under his kuti, under his dwelling place. And this monk, this particular monk, Ajahn Bunkhao, he would, oh, he's talking to another person, okay, and go into samadhi, just kind of, and then Ajahn Cha would sense when he was going into samadhi, and he would hit him with his cane and snap him out of it. Oh, and he started to get really kind of upset and irritated by Longpo Cha. So then eventually he thought, I've had enough of this. You know, getting into samadhi is easy for me. I'm going to go and I'm going to ask Longpo Cha, I'm going to take his leave, ask permission to go and practice in a cave somewhere. And so, because he has this natural ability, he can just go into a cave and bliss out and then not have to deal with all these people and all these things happening in the monastery. So he went to take leave of Longpo Cha, and Longpo Cha said, yeah, you can go to your cave and be happy when you're in your cave, or you can stay with me and learn how to be happy all the time. So that's the difference between just having samadhi or having samadhi and panya. Because the samadhi, the mind might be peaceful or happy or even blissful, but then once there's some sort of sensory contact, it's going to impinge upon it. But with the panya, with the discernment knows sense contact for what it is. So when sense contact comes up, then the discernment reflects on it naturally, and that impingement doesn't disrupt the mind. It doesn't cause the mind to waver. So a lot of us might have had this experience when we first start practicing. Usually the way it usually goes for people who have joined up in the monastery and decided to take ordination and devote their lives to trying to practice the Buddha's teachings, usually the way it goes is we have a good experience. We have some sort of maybe a smaller or greater samadhi experience. So we have some sort of peaceful experience. We come to meditation or we come to the monastery the first time and we hear the teachings and feel very inspired. And this is how it was for me. And I had this experience of meditating and wow, what is this? This is really interesting. So having a maybe one or two experiences of being a little bit peaceful and the mind settling and having an experience of letting go of some attachments, and then deciding, okay, this is it. This is it. I want to devote my life to this. I'm willing to give up all sorts of things, all sorts of good things in the world to come to the monastery and put on the robes and devote my life to this sila, this practice of sila, samadhi, and panya, and the Noble Eightfold Path. And the ajahns, the Kruba ajahns in Thailand, this is amazing. This whole world is totally amazing. So having this, we get hooked by having a good experience at first and then join up and then realize, okay, this is just a lot of hard work. Then the years of drudgery that follow, and it's been two, three years, and I haven't had that experience again. What's happening? So what's happening is when we had that experience at first, then it's like the mind, some of the coarser defilements may be settled temporarily, and we experience this coolness and sense of ease, but it was very, very tenuous. So any sort of impingement would cause it to disappear. So it's like an experience of having some samadhi, but without panya, with the discernment's not there yet, the wisdom's not there yet. And then, it's like the water became clear temporarily, but then there's all this gunk and poisonous muck underneath that water, and it's kind of settled temporarily. And then when we come to the monastery, usually the experience is we think we have more defilements and more suffering when we're in the monastery, but what's happening is then the monastic lifestyle is actually designed to be like we're actually digging down into that muck to get to the treasures that are buried underneath. And it's really stirring things up, so the heart will seem hot and bothered, and it's like we're kicking a hornet's nest when we decide to really call into question the defilements and all the attachments that we've never really questioned before. And if we want our mind to become very reflective, and we reflect on all of our behaviors and the things we're, the mental habits that we have, the speech habits that we have, the way we live our lives, and then we're taking on all these precepts in the monastery, and it's actually designed to be stirring things up, but it's stirring things up in a way of purifying the heart. So we're actually digging all that muck out and throwing it out, and we're getting to, well, the hope anyway, the carrot on the stick in front of us that the Buddha's holding in front of us, is that we're going to get to the treasure that lies underneath, the treasure in the heart itself. And the kind of crazy thing is it's all here. It's all in the heart. The Dhamma and the defilements are all here together. But it's more about looking to see how can we see and discern where the Dhamma is and where the how the heart can actually let go of the defilements and let go of attachment so that we can lift the veil and start to see things more clearly, more accurately. So it's hard work. We just come back to that, those basic activities of sitting meditation, walking meditation, doing the practice. And it's quite moving, I thought, watching this talk from Tenajin Chayasaro, the talk he gave at the Ngan Patipat, the Lompor Cha practice session, that it was the 33rd year since Lompor Cha passed away. And at Wat Nong Papong, Tenajin Chayasaro saying he was recollecting some words of Lompor Cha, that Lompor Cha would tell people, you know, I'm just like you. We're all people, and the hearts of people are the same. So I'm just like you. The only difference is I never gave up. So I practiced and never gave up. I never turned away from the practice. So, and that made me think of, I remember being a junior monk here at Abhayagiri 20 years ago, and Ajahn Jundi, a disciple of Longpo Cha, was visiting here, and this is in 2004, and he gave a talk one evening, and something in that talk that stayed with me was that he said something similar. He said, you know, all of you junior monastics, all of you people starting out, you might see us senior monks and think, oh, that's far off, that's far away. But actually, he said, I was just like you when I was 1 year as a monk, 2 years as a monk. I was just like you. I was just the same. I was just starting out. I was dealing with the same things, dealing with the same issues. And he said, just don't give up. Just don't give up. Just stick with it. Stick with the practice. The results of the practice do exist, and they can come. And there is people who have reached the results of the practice, and there are examples. There are people who can testify to the truth of the Buddha's teachings. It's not just theoretical. The truth of the Buddha's teachings, the Dhamma really does exist. The path really does bear fruit just in the way the Buddha said it does. And if followed correctly, then, and if the methods in the suttas and as taught by the Ajahns that have come before us, if we really do follow those methods of training that are time-honored and traditional, then we really will get to the results of the practice. But it's always hard won. These results are hard won. And through the course of the practice, what we don't really read in the books or in the suttas and the Buddha's teachings is just the things we're going to experience in the practice. So the suttas, the collections of the word of the Buddha, that's like a map. That's like a map that we use for the practice. And we do need to know the map. We do need to study the map. But the map doesn't tell us where there's going to be a log across the road, where there's going to be a downed power pole, what the weather is going to be like when we're on the road. The map just shows us a basic framework. So the suttas are, the Buddha has so many teachings about the things we might experience along the way as we practice. But we are, in the end, we're going to experience it for ourselves. So we're going to deal with all sorts of things as we walk the path. Boredom, things like boredom, loneliness, fear, resentment, all these things. We're going to have to get to know all these things that occur. And things like anger, rage, views and opinions, the suffering of our own views and opinions, coming up against ourselves, having to question ourselves. And we find also that along on the path of practice, as we start to develop discernment, and we read teachings of the Buddha like that ditupadana, the clinging to views and opinions, is suffering. Without letting go of that, we can't stop suffering. So we find on the path of practice that it's not about having the right views and opinions. So our views and opinions might be rational and logical and correct, even according to worldly standards, but it's not about having the correct views and opinions. It's about how do we hold our views and opinions? Can we hold them in a way that we're able to let them go? It's very difficult. Being right isn't liberation. Letting go is. We might have a bit of satisfaction from proving our friend that we were right and they were wrong. But it's a short-lived victory because it doesn't end suffering. Anytime we feel happiness, we call that sukha in Pali. Anytime we feel happiness, suffering's right around the corner, because there's something deep inside of us that knows it's very impermanent, that knows that it's just going to change. So any happiness we experience, it's not lasting. And because there's that knowledge that it's not lasting, there might be a subtle fear or a sense of dissatisfaction that our happiness, the happiness that we attain in our lives, is not lasting. And so that happiness is actually suffering. It's what the Buddha called. So the word for happiness is sukha. The word for suffering is dukkha. So in Thai, this is kwam suk and kwam tuk. And this sukha and dukkha, there's the suffering that is inherent in suffering. So there's suffering that is clearly suffering, the Buddha talked about. That's, you know, when we feel sadness and sorrow and heartbreak and all those things, and it's obvious. That's obvious suffering. That's what the Buddha called dukkha dukkha. Then there's happiness, which the Buddha said is also suffering. That's called sukha dukkha. Then there's the suffering that's just inherent in the conditioned world. That's called viparinama dukkha. So that's the suffering of change. So there's all this suffering that the Buddha talks about, all this dissatisfaction the Buddha talks about. And then we might actually suffer when we hear about all this suffering. It might make us suffer more. We might, well, what's the point? What's the point of anything if it's all just suffering? But the kind of paradoxical part of this, all of the discernment and so on, of sila, samadhi, panya, is that the realization of all of this is when things start to drop away. So that's when the mind has this quality of dispassion. Dispassion is when the mind becomes intensely sober. So we could think of practice as the cultivation of a very intense sobriety. And we're looking at the heart of addiction, the heart of craving, at its very root. And with this intense sobriety comes what we call nibbida. And nibbida is what we normally translate as world weariness. And this is a kind of calm acceptance of the way things are. Once there's that calm acceptance of the way things are, then liberation is right around the corner. So this is illustrated in a teaching of the Buddha. It's in the Dhammapada, I believe. This is things that are difficult. So, one, it is difficult to be born as a human being. So in the world of samsara, in the vata sangsan, in the cycle of existence, being born as a human being is rare and difficult. And we can take delight in the reflection that we've been born as human beings. Being born as human beings, we have the ability to hear about and even understand the Buddha's teachings. So it's rare in the world to be born as a human being. If one is born as a human being, it is rare to come into the contact with a Buddha's teaching. So we may have been born as human beings, but we don't come into any contact with the Buddha's teaching. Or if we hear about it, we might not have any faith in it. We might not feel anything, that it's not anything special. So for those who are born as human beings and come into contact with the Buddha's teaching, it is rare for someone to have confidence in the Buddha's teaching. For those who are born as human beings, come into contact with the Buddha's teaching and have confidence in it, it is rare to renounce the world and take up the ordination. For those who take up the ordination, it's rare to achieve a sense of contentment within the ordination. And then also for those who ordain and they do achieve a sense of contentment in the ordination, then for them, it's rare and difficult to, even though they've developed a sense of contentment, they might become heedless. They can still become heedless and actually just stop there. You know, have a sense of contentment, it's good enough. So it's rare and difficult then for one who's ordained and developed a sense of contentment to practice Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. This is what we call Dhamma Nudhamma Patipada. Practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. So that means setting aside our own views and opinions and bringing the mind into line with Dhamma rather than bringing the Dhamma into line with us. So Dhamma nu Dhamma Patipada, and then the Buddha talks about this particular quality as a foundation for stream entry, for seeing the first stages of enlightenment. And the Buddha gets asked this question by the monk, so what is difficult for one who practices Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma? And then the Buddha says, for them, Nibbana is close. So we're getting close to the end of the path at that point. So there will be a point when we start to intuitively sense that the end of suffering is a possibility, and that can give rise to a sense of burning faith and joy in the heart, a sense of great confidence and excitement even. This is what we call piti, or we can think of piti sukha, where it prods us along and keeps us going. So I don't want to say too much because it'll be hard to remember if I say too much, but at least a few words of encouragement and hopefully inspiration, and hopefully these words can help you to keep practicing and to not give up and just stick with it. And I hope that everyone here is able to use the time that they have in this short lifetime to practice skillfully and to make progress and become more and more, have more and more contentment and well-being as time goes on, and less suffering. So I'll leave that there for this evening's talk.